Well, we live in a world where 1 in 3 women and 1 in 7 men are victims of domestic violence. Just astounding. And just last week, as I spoke about, a man was convicted of murdering Jaden, an 11-year-old boy from Chicago who was trying to protect his pregnant mother from her ex-boyfriend. He had just been released from prison one day before as a convicted felon with a history of violence against women, and in particular, this woman. There have been way too many cases like this that we followed here in Chicago and across the country. And we're going to talk a little bit with two experts on this issue about a bill that's being proposed to help prevent just this kind of situation. With us to talk about it are Melanie Winston and Carrie Boyd. Carrie is the CEO, president of the Illinois Coalition Against Domestic Violence, which is a leading organization in Illinois dedicated to supporting survivors of domestic violence and to end violence. She has worked as a nonprofit executive director, lobbyist, lawyer, business leader, she devotes her time primarily to serving women. Melanie Winston is the president of the board of directors for the KLEO, Community Family Life Center in Chicago. The center is a nonprofit organization dedicated to strengthening families and communities by reducing violence. Welcome to the show, Melody and Carrie. How are you today? And happy Father's Day to you.
Hello. Well, thank you.
Hello.
Erin, happy Father's Day.
Oh, we lost Melody. So she's coming back. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about a new law that is being proposed. Actually, I think there are several laws that are being proposed, but why don't we start with the one that has to do with the parole board? Can you tell our listeners about it?
Yes, and thank you for having me today and bringing awareness to this extremely important topic.
Absolutely.
And in a nutshell, the law as proposed would require additional training for members of the parole board in order to make a recommendation for release of a person who is currently detained. And typically those folks in prison, as you know, Karen, have a history of violence. So if someone is in prison, they are in prison because they have been sentenced to a felony charge. Now, the difference between prison and jail, and I get this question a lot, is, well, jail is a lesser offense. It's typically a misdemeanor. But if you're in prison, you've been there for a felony charge, and it is typically a very serious offense. And so in order to get released or get early release and be up for what's called parole, you have to go before a board, and that board has to make a finding and a recommendation.
And so in this proposed law would allow the board to review the orders of protection and whatever domestic violence charges there were. Is that what the law says?
That is correct, yes. And one of the challenges is this information is not always widely available. And so I'm a former elected prosecutor. I also practice family law for almost 10 years, and there is not currently a uniform system where a police officer, a state's attorney, or any practitioner can go and say, okay, on James Doe, here are all of the charges related to this person, including orders of protection. We just don't have that. I can talk more about a solution to that later, but that is one of the big challenges.
And Carrie, you know, it is very interesting because I, too, practice in the family law realm. And normally speaking, everything that is a charge and a conviction, you can go to someone's criminal record and access that in one way, shape, or form. It's
yes.
getting easier these days with online tools and the like. It used to be you had to actually go to the courtroom and courthouse and, you know, plug in things in a computer. But the orders of protection are different because they're kind of quasi-civil criminal, which doesn't really mean much to the average listener, but they're not publicly available. And it seems to me, I guess it cuts both ways. If you're convicted you have an order of protection, you don't necessarily want everyone in the world to know it. But on the other hand, wouldn't she like to know it? If you're dating someone, or your daughter's dating someone, or you're getting out of prison, and how do you feel about the public availability of these records?
Great question. And there are nuances to this. So in general, the advocacy community for years has resisted a database or adding orders of protection to any kind of system. And the reason for that is, I'm sure Karen knows, but for listeners, is simply the weaponization and abuse of the orders of protection in the Illinois domestic violence statute in itself. So oftentimes, abusers will do what's called a race to the courthouse and claim that they are the victim when in fact they are the abuser. And so because this used to be so prevalent in the 90s and early 2000s, the advocacy community really resisted having those orders available as part of a police database or even public database. But like you said, nowadays most everything is online. And so if you're dating somebody, you can go to the county in which they live and put their name in the circuit clerk system and see if there's any kind of case pending. But that may not help you if they lived out of state or if they've moved around a lot and you just don't know where everyone's cases could be.
You know, you're absolutely right about that, because some of these the domestic violence offenders, it's not their first rodeo. You know, these are people who some of them at least have done this before. It's a habit, whether it's stalking or violence or verbal abuse or whatever it is. And so they know the court system better than most of the victims, unfortunately. And Melody, feel free to pipe in here. I know Carrie is a lawyer. You're not, but you're still an advocate in this community. What about domestic violence in the African American community is different? I know that is a focus of yours. Is it somehow different, worse, fewer people to advocate? What are the problems that you see?
I think the main problem that I see is that the resources sometimes are a bit more limited for us to be able to advocate and help families to overcome these type of issues or problems that they're going through in their communities. Or sometimes it's just looked over. You know, people turn a blind eye sometimes quicker in areas where the knowledge isn't there about how families should be structured and how people should behave. And so, just to speak to, what information is really available, some people don't know to go to your county website and actually do a search for, some type of abusive past behaviors. So I think that what's missing in our community, is just having people who can advocate for you and teach and mentor, train, coach families to be, more positive about their family structure.
We're speaking to Melody Winston and Carrie Boyd. We're talking about domestic violence. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about some other laws that are being proposed. And I, of course, want to talk about resources, and I want to talk about what do you do if you have a friend or a family member, or you are a person who's in an abusive relationship? How do you go about handling it? Talking to Melody Winston and Carrie Boyd. Carrie Boyd is the CEO and president of the Illinois Coalition Against Domestic Violence, and Melody Winston is the president of the board of directors of CLIO, Community Family Life Center. Welcome back to the show. Carrie, let me ask you, you are an attorney and you have practiced in this area. You've been on the prosecution side. You've been on the family law side of it. What do you think about the level of knowledge of the judges who are in the domestic violence courts? Do you think that they have enough training to do their jobs well, or do you think that they could use some more training in the nuances of domestic violence?
Yes. So judges are trained every other year through what's called the Illinois Judicial College. And so there's a whole office that works to coordinate trainings for judges through the Administrative Office of Illinois Courts. I am pleased to serve on the Domestic Violence Committee hosted by the Supreme Court. And what I can say really is the training has changed a lot in the last few years, and this office does a really great job of coordinating that information. That said, we can always use more training, always. Everything goes back to awareness and training, which is why this conversation is so important, so that people are aware. The next time judges will be trained on domestic violence specifically is at a summit this September that they will attend. I believe it's in Tinley Park. And then the biannual training conference will be in October of 2026. and domestic violence is specifically given time on that roster.
It just, it's so important in this area, I think. I mean, it's important for judges to be trained no matter what area they're in, whether it's housing or personal injury cases or whatever it is. But because the nuances of domestic violence, you know, involve emotions and involve family dynamics, yeah, and some behavior that's just not, is oddly unpredictable, that it's really good when you're in front of a judge who gets it and understands not just the recognizing it when they see it, but also in how to deal with it and how to manage those problems. So I'm glad, yeah, very glad to hear that. Melody, you kind of deal with the issue of kind of trying to prevent this violence from happening in the first place. For all of you out there who have children, young girls or young boys, what do you see when kids are growing up, Melody, that they should be aware of when it comes to domestic violence? What is the talk you have with your children?
Well, the talk is to be able to, one, that the parents really have to be involved, you know, and the kids. We've gotten to a place now, you know, where the kids are raising themselves. You know, they're on the electronics. They have friends that we are not familiar with, and they go places that, you know, that we didn't give them necessarily permission to go to. So the issues that we do right now at Clio Community Center is we bring them into a center. We bring them into a family environment, whether that's our after-school programs, whether it's the One Summer Chicago work programs, whether it's mentoring. We do a lot of things to help develop them, even a performing arts program, so that they start to get familiar and in kind with their emotions and how to communicate with others. So much of this is needed. I'm so happy to hear about the training program for the judges, because this is something that we can collaborate on, you know, as a community center, hoping that we can get closer to the judicial system before they have to go into, yeah, that system.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about some of the concrete things. How do orders of protection work? You've got somebody who is stalking you. You've got somebody who's doing committing violence against you. What are the tools that we have? Where do you go? Say you're in the Chicago area. Carrie, what does a person do?
It's a great question. So you have a couple of options. You can file this petition yourself, and they are available at the circuit clerk's office. I highly recommend you do not do that. If you need an OP, you should consult with an attorney if possible, if you can afford one. If not, we can arrange for resources for you to help walk you through that. And almost all of our member agencies offer some kind of referral system where there's a legal advocate who can be present with you, help you prepare the petition, help get it filed, talk with the local circuit clerk's office to get a court date, assist you in going to court, prepping your testimony. So all of these tools are available, and there's also what's called the emergency order of protection. Mm-hmm. So that is truly an emergency situation, and we have a lot of these, and that is where there's an immediate harm to the petitioner or protected children or some other dependent. What's really interesting about this emergency order is it hasn't changed a lot in a very long time. We all saw that come to a head on May 11th of this year, where Karina's Law took effect. And yes, the big piece about this, Karen, is now weapons, guns, and parts, mm-hmm, to make guns can be retrieved and seized as part of emergency order of protection. Mm-hmm. So the rate of domestic violence-related homicides has grown by 110% since COVID and during COVID. So this is an exceptionally amazing piece of legislation that the governor signed into law back in February, and it took effect in May.
And how would you answer the question, and we hear this all the time, an order of protection is only worth the paper it's written on. Not that we can always say like the percentages. What are the chances that an order of protection is actually going to work to stop somebody from being abusive, and under what conditions?
Yeah, and you're right. You know, and I learned this, too, as a baby lawyer, and I'm still learning it, is it's just very hard to put a moral compass in somebody who is determined to be abusive and is determined to inflict pain. That said, the order is only as good as the enforcement, and so the petitioner does have to enforce it. If, and I'm just going to say she, because statistically it is a woman, if she is being abused, threatened, harassed, stalked while an order is to call the police. And I realize that is a challenge in itself in some of our neighborhood communities who don't have great relationships with the police. Unfortunately, or fortunately, however one looks at it, Karina's law requires a tremendous amount of collaboration with law enforcement through the seizure of the weapons. There's a search warrant component. And so it does start with the petitioner to enforce the order. It may not be in the Leeds or police database, but it is enforceable by the police. And so oftentimes it's not worth the paper it's written on because the petitioner, it takes 5 to 12 times typically for somebody to leave an abusive situation. But once she's there and she knows there's no going back, it is an enforceable document. And it does save lives, and we believe will continue to save even more lives now with Karina's law and the seizure of weapons.
And, you know, ladies, can you hold for another segment after this break? Because I've got so many more questions for you. Is that okay?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay.
Sure.
We are here on the Karen Conchie Show talking to Melody Winston, president of the board of directors of Clio Community Family Life Center. She also is a senior executive of Living Fresh Market in Forest Park, which is the nation's largest black-owned full-scale supermarket. Very interesting concept. And Carrie Boyd, who is with the Illinois Coalition Against Domestic Violence. There, let's talk a little bit about what you should do if you know somebody in your family or in the neighborhood who you suspect is being abused. Let's start with you, Melody. What are some of the things that you should do? What should you not do when it comes to helping people through these issues?
Well, you know, I try to comfort, you know, encourage and empower, you know, that person as much as possible. Let them know that they've got family, people who care about them, and that they've got a place to go. Alerting the abuser or letting him or her know that you're on to him would be something that we would actually move away from. But sometimes it takes a minute to get a strategy. And like you said, it takes, Carrie, you said 12 times sometimes before, you know, they may make a move and do something where they can call the police to do something in a legal fashion.
And not to get too much into the weeds of the psychology of it, because we're not really addressing that, but I think it's just really important to try to figure out what is wrong with these people who do the stalking, who do the violence. Yeah. And, you know, in this yeah. case of Jaden, this poor little 11-year-old who was horribly murdered, you know, here's a guy who's in prison. The day he gets out, right. he goes right back to the girlfriend, you know, who he was abusing before, tries to kill her. Like, what is the malady that is going on with somebody who has these issues? And either one of you can address this.
Carrie, I'll let you go for that one.
Melody. Well, Melody and her team are really doing God's work at Clio, because they do try to get to the root of the problem and prevent it before it takes hold. And so a lot of it really does go to childhood. So adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, and there are tools, and we won't get into the details of it, but there are tools where you can, you know, make an educated evaluation about someone's likelihood to be an abuser. And it really does stem largely from experience being abused or witnessing it, which is why it is so critically important that we have organizations like Clio that help children, especially children in communities of color, get the support they need, because we know the rate of domestic violence is higher largely because they don't have the supports. And that's really where the coalition tries to come in too and offer that kind of training and awareness, both on a large level but also in on a family level. We do systems work. But it really does stem from some kind of violence upbringing or violence even in adolescence or young adulthood. But keep in mind, the fundamental behind all of this is power and control. And so somebody who is that angry and filled with rage is trying to control somebody else. And that's really what it all goes back to.
And do you see, and I see this in my practice, where it can start and it can be driven by financial abuse, which is the controlling of finances and making, and we'll say women because it goes both ways, dependent. And so kind of isolating that person from money, isolating that person from family and friends, and all of a sudden the woman is without any resources to deal with what she's getting. Do you see that quite a bit?
Oh, yes. And the statute was amended over 20 years ago to include financial and emotional abuse.
Wow.
Sometimes people think of domestic violence as physical abuse, and that is very much a part of it. But, you know, we get the question all the time, why does she stay? The better question that you're raising is, why does the abuser abuse? And that's really the right question to ask. And emotional and economic abuse are some of the biggest forms of domestic violence. And it doesn't just start out like that on the first date, right? It happens over time. And then you're at a point where you don't even realize what's really happening until it's there. And I can tell you, I've worked with women who have been in horrific relationships and marriages for decades who didn't know that there was another way. That's all they've ever known. And so it really does start with power and control, and the economics of it all are a huge factor in that equation.
And when a person, let's circle back to the idea of, you know, you said there are these places you can go, you can get an advocate, you're best off getting a lawyer, and I will say that you can mm-hmm. go to court. It's not as user friendly as you think it would be, even though we're on Zoom a lot of times now. Unless you know the rules of evidence, unless you know what the judges are looking for, unless you know what the law says about what's prohibited and not prohibited, you might miss it. You might not testify,
right,
you know, exactly as you should, and the judge can't really help you. The judge is not really allowed to tell you what the law is or to guide you through that process. So, if it's a bad situation and you are concerned about your life and your well-being or that of your children, you know, you really need to find a way to pay a lawyer to do this for you and to do it right. In my view, do you agree with that?
Definitely.
Go ahead, Melody. Go ahead.
I was just looking at the financial and the emotional abuse now and how things have changed, especially since COVID and now with the administration changing, and we may be losing some of these resources. Cleo Community Center started because Cleo Barrett was shot by her boyfriend, and she was a Cook County sheriff. She had just ended the relationship. It was a Sunday. She was headed to church. Her father and parents are pastors, and she didn't show for church. And when they found her, she was dead, and her boyfriend had shot himself as well. And so, you know, you look for the signs, and sometimes we think we do know the signs, but when you just mentioned, you know, financial, you know, as can be a reason for this abuse to take a pattern against an individual, that was something new, and that's more of a reason that we would collaborate with the coalition to learn more about how we can help these communities.
Let's give out some information about where people can go, hotlines, numbers, whoever wants to answer that question, please do. And everyone, if you don't get these numbers down or the hotline numbers, you can always email me at WGN at AskKarenConti.com, and I will be happy to relay them to you. Ladies?
Well, I will say for the coalition, our website is ilcadv.org, and we are the only statewide organization that has a footprint in all 102 counties. We are a membership organization. And so if you're experiencing a need in Jackson County, Cook County, Will County, Adam, wherever you are, we can help you and put you in touch with local resources. And so I can share our phone number to the coalition.
Go ahead.
Which is, yes. So that phone number is 217-789-2888. 1-800-273-8830. And you can call there. We have somebody answering the phone 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we'll be happy to direct you to your local resource. And you can also get on that website, and there is a statewide hotline as well. And so that's the resource that I would recommend for the coalition, is starting with ilcadv.org. And we can help you from there.
Melody Winston and Carrie Boyd, thank you so much for joining me for this very, very important issue. Continue the good work.